May 24, 1988. New Orleans. Late afternoon, and the sky over southeastern Louisiana is doing what Louisiana skies do in May. Building towering cumulus stacking up in the warm Gulf air. Anvils spreading outward at altitude, the kind of weather that makes dispatchers check the radar one more time before signing off on a release, on the surface. New Orleans International, they didn't rename it for Louis Armstrong until later, is handling the routine business of a busy afternoon, arrivals and departures. Controllers working the frequency in that measured cadence that sounds calm even when it isn't. Somewhere out on the approach, a Boeing 737 is descending through the buildups. I'm Tail Dragger. This is The Hangar, on Radio Hangar. Today I want to sit down with one of the great airmanship stories of the jet era, a story that doesn't get nearly enough time in pilot conversations. A story about what it looks like when the situation goes fully sideways and a crew refuses to give up the airplane. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Now, TACA International Airlines. If you came up flying in North America, you may not know the name well. TACA was a Central American carrier based out of San Salvador, El Salvador. Solid operation? They flew routes through Central America and the Caribbean that didn't make it onto travel magazine covers but were absolutely essential to commerce and movement in that part of the world. Belize City, Guatemala City, San Jose, Miami, Houston, New Orleans. Flight 110 on May 24th was one of those routine legs. Belize City's Philip Goldson International to New Orleans. The aircraft was a Boeing 737, the 300 series, one of the newer classic series jets with the CFM56-3 high-bypass turbofan engines. That engine designation is going to matter. We'll come back to it. The flight deck crew was Captain Carlos Dardano and First Officer Beto Dovas. I want you to remember that name. Carlos Dardano, we'll come back to him too. The passenger load was 38. With the flight deck and cabin crew, there were 45 souls aboard, a normal Tuesday. People with luggage in the belly and reasons to get to New Orleans. As the flight approached the New Orleans area and began its descent, the convective system that had been building all afternoon was right where they needed to go, not off to the side, not something you could thread around with a modest deviation. It was sitting on the approach end, a significant cell with embedded thunderstorms, and a core that radar was painting in solid returns. The crew did what crews do, they tried to navigate it. You look for gaps, you ask the controller what other traffic is reporting. You buy maneuvering room if you can find it, but sometimes the weather doesn't offer you clean options. That afternoon, the weather wasn't in a generous mood. They flew into heavy rain, and then the hail started. Now, here's where I need to talk about the CFM56-3 for a moment. The 56-3 was a relatively new power plant in the commercial fleet by 1988, significant step forward in fuel efficiency and performance for the narrowbody market. Airlines loved it. But the industry was still building its operational experience base with this engine design. And there was a characteristic of the 56-3 that would become painfully apparent that afternoon in May. These engines did not handle simultaneous large-scale water and hail ingestion well. The geometry of the engine, the fan stages, the compressor stages, the tight tolerances built in for the sake of efficiency, created conditions where flooding the inlet with water and hail at the same time could cause the compressor to stall. A compressor stall disrupts the smooth, continuous airflow through the engine that makes combustion possible, enough of them, severe enough, fast enough, and the fire goes out. The left engine flamed out, and then, almost immediately, so did the right, both engines, simultaneously. I've talked to pilots about that moment, the moment when both engine out enunciators light up, both EPR needles start unwinding, both tachometers winding down, and the common thread in those conversations is a very specific kind of quiet, not the quiet of everything being under control, the quiet of the universe rearranging itself into a new configuration that has no good name for it yet. Back in the cabin, the passengers knew something had changed. The engine noise, that constant reassuring background hum that airline passengers learned to ignore, was gone. The vibration changed. Somewhere in the back of that airplane, people who had been reading magazines or dozing looked up from their seats and felt something wrong in a way they couldn't quite name. On the flight deck, there was no time for that uncertainty. Dardano and Dovas went straight to work. Restart procedures. That's what you do. The training produces this response. When the worst thing happens, you don't freeze and you don't narrate the situation. You work the problem. Engine restart memory items. Fuel, ignition, airspeed for windmill restart. Both pilots running their respective flows while the aircraft continued descending through the weather, the altimeter unwinding. Because here's the hard truth about a Boeing 737 with both engines offline. It is not a good glider. The glide ratio on the 737 without thrust is roughly 17 to 1, 17 feet forward for every foot of descent. In the abstract, that sounds workable in practice. In a 140,000-pound jet, at the altitudes they were working from, that ratio translates into altitude loss at a rate that concentrates the mind considerably. You are descending, continuously. Every second is costing you altitude you are not getting back. The APU, the auxiliary power unit, was still running, which gave them some electrical power and some hydraulic pressure, but the APU does not produce thrust. For every purpose that matters in this scenario, the 737 had become, in the truest sense, a glider. The heaviest and least aerodynamic glider most people will ever set eyes on. And now Dardano had to answer a question that commercial airline pilots train for theoretically but almost never face in reality. Where do we put it? New Orleans is not an easy place to find an emergency landing site for an airliner.
The city is built largely below sea level on a delta. The terrain around the airport is a patchwork of suburban development. Drainage canals, waterways, and the infrastructure that keeps the whole enterprise from reverting to swamp. The Mississippi River is nearby. Lake Pontchartrain is nearby. Interstate 10 cuts through the area a few miles north, and none of those options are where you want to point a 737. But there are levees, earth and flood control levees, some of them broad and grassy, running through the terrain around the airport and the Kenner District to the west. Not a runway, not close to a runway, but ground, flat-ish, grassy ground, that a very good pilot might be able to use. Now here's where it gets interesting. What Dardano calculated in real time in the span of the few minutes available to him was that one of those grassy levee areas might work. Might be long enough, might be firm enough, might catch a 737 and let it stop without killing everyone aboard. This was not a situation with multiple options being weighed against each other. This was the option one shot. The gear came down on gravity extension. No engine-driven hydraulic pumps, but the accumulators held enough residual pressure to extend the gear and maintain control authority for the approach. Airspeed control configuration. You fly the aircraft to the numbers because the aircraft doesn't know what's below it, and your job is to put it where it needs to go at the speed it needs to be at. Captain Carlos Dardano set a Boeing 737 down on the grass, not on a runway, not on a taxiway, on a grassy levee near Kenner, Louisiana, outside New Orleans, in weather that had just taken both of his engines away from him. Let me say it plainly, so it lands properly. 45 people were aboard that airplane. Not one of them suffered a serious injury. Not one. They opened the doors and people walked away from a 140,000-pound jet that had touched down on a grass field with no thrust, because the man in the left seat flew it all the way, every foot of the way, to that exact piece of ground. Now I told you to remember that name?
Carlos Dardano. Here's why. Captain Dardano had lost a leg in an accident years before the events of May 24, 1988. He flew on a prosthetic limb. The man who dead-sticked a twin-engine jet airliner onto a Louisiana levee and walked 45 people away. He did it on one natural leg. You can sit with that for a moment, I always do, in the days that followed as the investigators arrived, and the engineering teams came down from Boeing and TACA mobilized its own resources, someone asked a question that itself became one of the more remarkable chapters of this story. Those engines, the CFM56-3s that had flamed out from water and hail ingestion, they hadn't been destroyed by fire or catastrophic mechanical failure. They'd been overwhelmed and shut down, which raised the question, could they be replaced on site? In a proper maintenance environment, a heavy engine change on a commercial jet is an involved job. You need proper tooling, ground support equipment, a hangar, quality control documentation. It's a defined procedure, but it takes time and the right setup. They did it on the levee. In a field in Kenner, Louisiana, replacement engines came in, ground support equipment was rigged, the old engines came off, new engines went on. Over several days, the maintenance crew turned a grass levee that had been an emergency landing strip into an open-air engine change facility. And when the new power plants were on and the systems tested, a ferry crew climbed back into that 737 and flew it off the levee, short field departure.
Grass surface. An airplane that had arrived without engines leaving under its own power. If you've never seen photographs of that operation, the 737 sitting in the field, the engine change underway, the sheer improbability of it, go find them. There's something about a commercial jet surrounded by ground support equipment in a Louisiana field that defies easy description. It looks like something staged for a movie, except it actually happened. The NTSB investigated thoroughly. The FAA looked hard at the CFM56-3's ingestion characteristics in combined water and hail conditions. CFM International and the airframers addressed the problem. Procedures were updated. Engine certification standards were revisited. Crew training for dual engine failure scenarios received sharper attention across the industry.
That's how aviation gets safer, by the way. Not by pretending that nothing will ever go wrong. By paying honest attention when something does. Back when I was flying approaches into Houston and Miami and Chicago in convective weather, I used to think about what a dual engine failure checklist actually demands of you. The procedures are solid, they're there.
but there is a long road between running those items in a simulator and running them in a real airplane while the altimeter unwinds and the terrain picture starts to get personal. What Dardano and Dovis did that afternoon was not luck. It was not magic. It was the product of training, experience, discipline, and a particular quality that the best pilots I've ever known share, a fundamental refusal to stop flying the airplane until it is fully stopped on the ground. They flew the 737. They flew it all the way. When the landing surface turned out to be a grass levee, they flew it to that too. Pull up a chair and think about your own flying for a minute. When's the last time you genuinely briefed an engine out scenario before a flight? Not the academic review, but the actual private conversation. Where am I going if I lose it on rotation? What do the terrain options look like on departure? What's the longest flat surface within glide distance of my climb-out path? That mental rehearsal isn't pessimism. That's the groundwork that comes before the performance. Dardano and Dovis had done that work. They'd done it before May 24, 1988, ever showed up on the calendar. The 737 that sat in that field in Kenner flew for years after the repairs were complete. Carlos Dardano kept flying. The story entered the NTSB records and the aviation safety literature, and if you go looking for it, the primary sources are all publicly available. Sources today include the National Transportation Safety Board's accident report on TACA Flight 110, and reporting from Aviation Week and Space Technology that documented the event and the subsequent investigation in detail. More stories at RadioHangar.com. I'm Taildragger. Fly it all the way to the end.